got a variety of things to talk about this week, starting with a few small things back to back. The first thing I want to mention is that as of the 10th of January, Apple's accepting donations to aid the Australian bushfire relief on Apple.com. I believe in the App Store and iTunes, you can donate from the U.S. It goes to the American Red Cross, and 100% of the donations, so there's no commissioner fees. And you can donate between $5 and $200 per donation. And this is something I know you have a lot of listeners in Australia based on, you know, or we at least we get the most feedback from our listeners in Australia. So I especially want to point this out. That is a thing that you can do.
Yeah. And this is obviously on top of Apple's, like Tim Cook at the end of 2019 announced that they were doing like a donation mm-hmm. from the company as well. And this is just facilitating, making it easier for their customers to also. To also participate, because there was a bit of backlash about this. I did a story on this, and
yeah,
a few people were like, wow, the great Apple is letting other people give the money to the charity. It's like, come on, like, it's a, you know, it's a nice thing to do. It makes it easier if you can pay with your iTunes credit, or you can pay with, you know, your payment methods in iTunes, great. You don't have to, you know, if you don't want to, you don't have to, but it's there, and it's a lot easier than, you know, finding the various charities online or whatever if you can just press the button inside the App Store. Like, it's a cool gesture. And did you see Amazon got a lot of backlash this week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for around the same thing. And you'll note that Apple doesn't actually release the value of their personal contributions or the company contributions to kind of, like, you know, deflect some of the criticism that Amazon got. Like, everyone realistically, even if they did announce a number, everyone, there'd still be people complaining it was too low or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just the internet. But the iTunes thing is perfectly fine, in my opinion, at least. It's like, you know, it's not in the way. They have a nice little banner on the homepage, and you want to donate to charity, here you go. You know, just press here and do it.
Yeah, when you see the images coming out of Australia, it's really sad. And to go on Apple's homepage and to see the first thing is the iPhone 11 Pro, it's like, $1,000 phone. Okay, a banner for donating is the perfect place for that, because otherwise, you know, you kind of tone deaf there. So that's good. Happy to see that. And of course, you know, if any listeners have it, I'd encourage you to go and check it out. You can just go to apple.com is the easiest way to do that. Next up is another story that you covered, which is a smart battery case replacement program, which affects the 10S and the 10R smart battery cases.
Basically all of the smart battery cases for the 10S and the 10R generation, because it runs from models dated January through October. So, yeah, basically all of them that they ever sold could have an issue where they wouldn't charge reliably. And this is actually a kind of resolution to, not a gate, because obviously the smart battery cases don't sell in high enough volumes to really make like a massive complaint. But I had actually seen people saying that their smart battery case didn't charge very well, and it wouldn't, sometimes they put it in their phone and it wouldn't top up. And I even had a couple of people on Twitter ask me about it and stuff, and I never had a issue when I used the 10S battery case with the iPhone 10 for a little while. I didn't have a problem with it, but, you know, it's basically, if you have one of these cases, you should go and get it swapped out. And they say it may only affect a percentage of the devices, but they'll recall and swap anything, even if it's not currently exhibiting the issue, because it could happen.
That makes sense.
In the future.
Yeah. So if your case doesn't do the one thing you expect it to do, now it can. There's a program for that.
Yeah, look, there's always this thing with the repair programs, which was a bit like not great. Is people were complaining about this in like March, and they only acknowledge it in January of the following year. So there's always quite a lag, I think, and that's one thing to be critical of. Is that, yeah, now, you know, finally you get there and they let you do these repair programs, but they always feel like they're slightly too late than what is actually like justified. If you know, I'm sure there's loads of like legalese and testing and, you know, nailing down which models.
Yeah,
there's
a process
for here. Yeah, there must be a load of stuff that
and finding a fix for it before you start.
Yeah, yeah. There's all this gump that's a lot more complicated than, you know, just open a repair program sooner. But I've seen that this is like a trend running on, because Apple's had, you know, their fair share of repair programs in the last couple of years, and they're all like a year after the device comes out. It's like, oh yeah, that you could have been having a problem with this product for literally the entire year. And then the things that's actually really bad are the repair programs that are secret, and It's like ordering the secret menu off at a restaurant, but it's like the secret list of repair programs that Apple, if you ask a genius and you get them to look at the right documents on their internal systems, Apple is actually doing free repairs for these things. One of the most obvious being the LCD stain gate stuff and the like stage lighting with the backlighting issues on the laptops. And they've never announced public repair programs for most of those things. Or they have bundled only for very specific models. But behind the scenes, if you know the right people, or you can get the Apple Store support to look in the right place, they are actually doing repairs and that stuff. That's the thing where it's like really bad, I think, like in terms of just like general Apple support. Like the stain gate problem with the screens, and like basically the layer on the bezel layer of the screen gets like the glue or the connection weakens over time, and you just get these big patches all over the screen. Like that's been an issue since like the 2014 MacBook Pro, and they're still doing repairs on it 5 years later, and they still won't acknowledge it publicly at all. Like, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it seems, I think from their perspective, if they think that a few enough people have it, then not to announce it. And then if it's a problem that's so obvious that you can see it and it's like undeniable, then you'll know, and you'll know when you know without being, you know, needed to be told about it. But yeah, I totally get you. When they have, they're documented internally, and any genius can find them, but customers have to, like, you know, look for 9-to-5 Mac coverage of these things based on what we can find.
Yeah, wage a war. Because then you can go in with one of these issues, like, and then if you get the wrong time of day, the genius will just tell you, oh yeah, you have to pay $400 to get the screen fixed or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And then if you go in at a different time of day, and maybe they got a bit more time in their hands, they do a bit more research, all of a sudden they find the special document that says this is covered under some, you know, internal program that isn't officially a program, but here you go. Like, it's just a big mess. That kind of stuff should be eliminated.
But. Yeah. Next up is a new app for the Mac called Sensei, S-E-N-S-E-I. And it's one of these like all-in-one Mac tidiness apps and like Mac health apps, you know, for your computer, where it's kind of a combination of a bunch of different utilities for the Mac that you can you know sort of get individually, but it's all in one. And what's nice about it is so they do this SSD trim feature, they do battery health, they do storage management, and different things like that. But it's really nicely designed in that it kind of looks like this could be part of the system if Apple wanted it to be, of just like, this is your Mac health. I think it's like $30 a year or $60 for a lifetime license. So if you plan on using it for more than 1 year, then you should probably just buy it. But I got to try it out, and it's pretty cool. Like I can see on my MacBook Pro 16-inch 2019, You've got the model, the serial number, the release date, November 13th, 2019, the manufacturing date, which is 1 month prior to that in October, the origin of Quanta Computers, and then lots of other stuff, and the battery health, for example, like 98%. And I think when I first opened it, it was like 99%, and then it went to 98%, and then you can see all the charge cycles and everything, how it's getting the number. And then there's really cool stuff for like managing apps that are installed, getting back storage, and then even for like the graphics cards inside your computer, they've got really good, like realistic icons of those, the graphics. And like, if I plug up my display, it has my display there as well. And then cooling, you can see, like, I'm looking at the cooling section and like see my Mac fans, and then it's got the revolutions per minute of the left side fan and the right side fan, and like their different speeds. The max speeds of each one of those, and it's like animating like the fan is. And then it's got thermal sensors, CPU, storage, memory, palm rest, Thunderbolt, enclosure, GPU, logic board, airport wireless. So all this data that's just like neat to kind of peek at. And then like in the battery section, for example, it's got the temperature of the battery, and then it's also got, you know, you've got your milliamps by design, the current capacity, the max capacity. And the icon for that is like what you would see if you took the battery out of the Mac. So it's just really nicely designed as a Mac utility app.
Check it out. A lot of those like stats you can find if you go into like the system report menu.
As like, yeah, like text items and all that.
Yeah, like the system report menu is very ugly and not very nice.
Yeah, this should be the system report menu, basically.
Yeah, like if you look at About This Mac, they've over the years, over each OS version, they've tidied that bit up a bit. So you get like a nice, especially on like the RAM screen, you get a nice graphic of the RAM situation, then external displays and stuff like that. But if you actually press the more button, and there's quite a lot of stuff hidden behind that more button.
That's like, right.
You know, GPU information or network drives and stuff like that, and network cards. All of that's just like this ugly, like split view, blue and white thing. So
yeah. So there's just a lot of tasteful choices that they made in this app. Like if you go to the uninstaller, so you know that there's no like built-in app uninstaller. I use AppZap or something like that to like get the files that aren't just in the applications folder. AppZapper is the name of it. It's like the ray gun icon, and you can like drag and drop an app icon onto it, and it'll find not just the application in the applications folder, but also like if they've got support files throughout the system, and get rid of those. And that's like one of the big differences between the Mac and Windows is that there's not like a built-in uninstaller per se. You just drag and drop that to the trash can and into the trash can. But in this, on the uninstaller in the Sensei app, they've got this like animating section of two columns of apps going down and one in the middle of apps going up, but they use the app icons from what's on your Mac. So at a glance, it's like generic app icons, but then you pay attention to it and it's like, these are actually all the apps on my Mac. So they're fetching that data and they're making like that animation custom to, you know, your machine. So just a lot of really good touches in terms of design in this app. So
check it out. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
One kind of like phenomenon that I noticed when I use my a Windows machine, which I basically just only play games on, is obviously over the years Windows has had several like UI themes similar to like what we've seen on iOS with you know the iOS 6 era, the iOS 7, then the kind of refinements beyond that. What you find on Windows, like if you go into the first level control panel, everything looks super modern. Then you go into the second level control panel, and you can start to see some of the old stuff seep in, and then you click on like a link in that second tier control panel, and then everything looks like Windows 2000.
Yeah.
Just like the design of everything. It's really funny how it's like very like surface level, and the Mac has some of that, and like system reports kind of an area like that, but it's less obvious, or at least less permissive.
Yeah. It doesn't look dated. It just looks like it's not as pretty.
Like you can tell it's from a different like era of the design of the operating system.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the in Notification Center where they have the little toggles at the top for like Night Shift and Do Not Disturb. And they, until like this last version, they still had the little like on labels on them, like iOS 5. It's like they look like iOS 5 switches literally until Catalina when they like fixed them up.
Yeah. Two more things on Sensei before we move on from that. They do promise in the first quarter of this year fan controls, so not just the ability to see like fan speeds and temperatures, but also ability to control those, I suppose. And then the other thing is that they do a 14-day free trial. So if you don't want to pay the $29 per year or the $59 for a lifetime license, then you can just try it out for a couple of weeks and see what you think about it. So Sensei. Next up is an Apple acquisition of another company. This is based on they're an artificial intelligence startup. The thing that's interesting about this is that it's the company. I don't know how you say this. It's I guess it's Nor, but it's X N O R, and
it's Tenor.
It's Tenor. Of course, this is where they get the name from for the iPhone. Yeah, whatever you call this company, they're a low power AI startup, and they've shown off some things like the ability to have a solar powered chip that does AI features on device, and so that's up Apple's alley. But what's interesting here is that they specifically have a person detection feature on device, speaking Apple's language, that the affordable smart camera company Wyze, W-Y-Z-E, used since like last summer to use as their on-device person detection feature. And a few weeks ago, or like a week ago, they had to issue an update and a statement saying that a future update to the firmware on their cameras would remove their on-device person feature because of a licensing change due to the unexpected termination of our agreement with our AI provider. So they weren't rolling their own person detection feature. They were licensing it. And Apple bought the company who was licensing it to them. And so now Apple owns that, and Wyze isn't going to have anymore. And, you know, just that alone, you can imagine that Apple's just going to beef up their HomeKit Secure Video feature of person detection, which is already in a HomeKit Secure Video, whenever they take over a camera's features and make it the HomeKit, you know, video camera with their own set of features on device. And in this case, maybe a feature that's already exists just gets a whole lot better. And there's definitely room for that if you've seen reviews of people testing HomeKit Secure Video, where you no longer rely on like Logitech's person detection, but Apple's person detection.
Yeah, it definitely seems like Apple's first round attempt at it was pretty crude. And like, that was one of the main complaints in the wake of people getting like Logitech cameras on the HomeKit Secure Video stuff, was aside from the, you know, wonky like HomeKit configuration situations, it was just like the motion detection wasn't as smart as what they were using before, and things that wouldn't be detected as people were being, or it was being overly sensitive and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure the Tenor acquisition can help with that. And obviously, you know, it's just a perfect synergy for Apple in terms of, you know, on-device machine learning, intelligent stuff, to buy a company in that domain.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And at $200 million, it's rumored at, that's quite sizable on terms of like Apple's acquisitions ever, because, you know, their biggest acquisition ever continues to be Beats, which is $3 billion. And then you only have to go a couple of steps down and you're in the, like, you know, you're in the couple hundred millions. For a company that's worth like more than $1 trillion, it's actually kind of remarkable how small their acquisitions have been.
Yeah.
They did the Intel like modem business acquisition. That was $1 billion, and that was like their third biggest ever. So if you're at $200 million, you must be in like the top 10-ish. So.
Well, wasn't Instagram like $1 billion whenever Facebook bought Instagram? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, you know, what, a 20th of it's a fifth of Instagram.
A fifth, yeah.
Yeah, a fifth of Instagram. So 20% of Instagram. Yep. All right. There's also a lot of news going on this week about, it's like a replay of several years ago, where there's this whole back and forth between Apple and the FBI and the US government. What do you have to say on this, Mayo, this week?
Yeah, like a replay of what's happened before is a good description. So there was obviously this shooting in the Navy base at the end of last year, and the government are doing their investigations. They need data. Apple said that they cooperated as they always do when they come with subpoenas, and they gave them all the iCloud data that exists. So they actually said they gave over gigabytes of data, which probably means like a load of photos and stuff backed up or whatever. But the FBI came forward and started making some noise that, you know, Apple wasn't cooperating and that they weren't helping them actually get access to the physical phones in question. And the phones are obviously locked with a passcode and they can't get into them. And then, at least in terms of what the FBI claimed, was they were unable to like hack into them either. And that's like fair enough. Okay, there's a situation. Before Apple's reply comes out, we know what it's going to be. They obviously defend the encryption stance very heavily, and repeating the arguments that we did have in the 2016 San Bernardino case, which actually did go to trial. If Apple believes that if they made a backdoor for one person, then the backdoor would get out and then everyone's devices would be compromised in the same way, which is very logical and sound thinking. At first, it did seem like this case was slightly different in that the phone in the... Because, obviously, the San Bernardino shooting was 2015, the devices at the time are quite old. So the phone in question at the center of that case was an iPhone 5C. And that device didn't even have a secure enclave because it didn't have Touch ID or anything, right? It was basically an iPhone 5 in a plastic shell.
Mm-hmm.
So that device was particularly susceptible to getting hacked into and compromised by third-party companies. And at the time, the trial began, and then like it got vacated because the FBI worked with a company called Cellebrite, and they reportedly paid in the region of $1 million to do whatever special exploit they needed to do to get into the device, because, you know, Apple wouldn't make an official unlock for it. And that dissipated the court case, which was, I think, Apple was pretty happy about, to be honest. Like, it's kind of a dirty secret, but as long as these third-party companies exist, it kind of relieves pressure on Apple, because at some point they can just say, look, just go and get these people to do it. We don't want to, you know, we don't want to compromise the security of our customers, but we can, like, on the down low, acknowledge that these exploits do exist out in the wild. So just go over here and get it done.
Yeah, it's an older and supported device at this point.
Yeah. So I had assumed that with this case, the device in question were going to be a lot newer. And over the course of the last few days, it's actually turned out that there are two phones involved, and one of them's an iPhone 7. Okay, so that's 2016. And then the other device is an iPhone 5. And so the other phone, the iPhone 5, is actually older than the 5C that was at the center of the 2016 situation. Mm-hmm. And so it's very likely that the same exploit that they used in 2016 could be used to get into the iPhone 5 device. So arguments from the FBI that they can't get into this phone is, you know, kind of a weak landing. Plus the fact that in the 5 years since the San Bernardino situation, the availability and distribution of these kind of like grey market companies that can friendly access devices using these like the grey shift boxes and Cellebrite and companies like that, the prices have gone down dramatically. So in 2015, the FBI had to shell out like $1 million. Today, in today's money, you can, if you've got 15 grand, you can get into an iPhone 5C in like not for much time at all. And then the iPhone 7 also has known exploits as well. And it probably will take a bit longer because the secure enclave will protect some stuff. And if it's been updated, it will even have the, what's that feature called in the thing they added where it ignores USB when you plug it in, mm-hmm, and it's locked, the USB stuff gets disconnected. That thing could be enabled as well, which does make it slightly more harder, but it's still very, very possible. Because in addition to plenty of other exploits in the vicinity, the Checkmate jailbreak situation is actually like a boot ROM exploit that is essentially hardware unpatchable. So any devices from like the iPhone 4S, the iPhone 10 have pretty gaping holes in their like hardware security if you can get hands on the physical devices. So with that in mind, the FBI's argument that they need Apple's help definitely is very thin ice. And so I went from kind of like being sympathetic to their cause to being, you know, I definitely joined the critic's side once we learned that the devices were so new, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it could be that they're letting that situation be a reason to pursue what they obviously want to pursue, which is having an official backdoor without having to rely on these other companies, but having Apple's direct participation, not just ensuring what's available to the cloud, but also what's on device. And so they maybe like the optics enough of this particular case that they say, like, this is, you know, PR wise, we could win this one, even if there are other ways about it. That's what we don't know yet is what are they actually trying, you know, with known ways, because they know about these other ways too.
I mean, that's like the constant argument is that you've got all of this iCloud data. Do you really need anything? Like, what are you actually thinking is going to be on the phones themselves that's actually going to make a difference to the investigation, right? Even if it was like just walk in and get it, like what difference is they're going to be on there? Because the current state of iCloud is that like messages are end-to-end encrypted, but if you do iCloud backups, then the decryption key is stored with the backup. So any subpoena can get the messages and they get the decryption key so they can read your messages. Photos are stored encrypted but not end-to-end encrypted, so they can be decrypted very easily. And, you know, you get raw photo data. Quite a lot of the information that's actually stored in, you know, on your phone, it can be as secure as it wants to be on the device. But if you're using the iCloud features, which most people have to because, you know, iCloud's the only option for real full device backup, and they don't have any sort of like end-to-end option for the full backup at the moment, you know, quite a lot of your day is just kind of like sitting on Apple servers, chilling out, and Apple's running around doing all these privacy advertisements and, you know, what's on your iPhone stays in your iPhone and stuff. But if you actually come down to it and think about it logically, a lot of what on your iPhone is stored on a server somewhere accessible to like any government institution that can present a subpoena. So like, I think Apple's definitely seen some stresses in both directions. Like they have a concern, obviously, about the public reaction and the government reaction and the criticisms come from like the PR side of the matter as they kind of lobby this in front. And what will probably happen in that is like the FBI will just give Apple something at some point and they'll just use one of these third-party hacks to get into it, or Apple will like direct them to someone that they know can do it because they don't want to come out and say our older phones have a load of exploits,
right?
But they know about them, obviously, so they could like do some statement which is like, we helped the FBI in their investigation, we directed them to some security companies, that, you know, they can flare up the language. But this again, if they really need access to those phones, there are ways to do it. So that this will get dissolved once the, you know, PR fiasco dies down or whatever.
Yep.
And hasn't stopped being so politically maneuvering about it.
Hasn't Tim Cook like publicly considered making it impossible to even do the iCloud recovery stuff. Like it would
yeah,
be
so
difficult for customers, kind of like, but
yeah, like people have been asking for it for like about a year or so now. And Cook said there are difficulties and you know, edge cases they have to consider, but it's on our radar. And that is true, because the reason they don't, like, the point of having a backup is so that if you get into a situation where, you know, you lose your phone or whatever, or you forget and stuff, you know, you want to get your information back. And for the vast majority of people in the world, being able to get your data back whilst having forgot your password is more important than having your photos stored, you know, end-to-end securely, right? So there is complexity there where they don't want to make it too easy for people to turn on this switch that will actually like backfire them in the end. Because say if, you know, you have your phone, you've got all your photos stored end-to-end encrypted in an Apple database, so the only way to get into it is by actually remembering your password that can be very, very long. And then one of these days you come along, you forget your password and all of your phone, and you lose your phone and all of your like family photos are lost forever. Like, that is going to cause a hell storm of backlash, right? People are going to hate that, like, because they won't understand the consequences up front. But you do have members of society and people that want to explicitly opt into that extra level of protection. Like, I wouldn't do it. I think it's like pointless. Like, you know, I'd rather have the like peace of mind that if it came down to it, you know, I can actually get my pictures back, right? Versus I really have to remember this like 12 character password forever, and any loss or whatever will mess me up for good. But there are people in the world, you know, heads of state, really important people, CEOs, that maybe have like exclusive devices that they do generally want to be locked down as possible, to be as secure as possible, and not to be compromisable. And so offering in some way a way to do an entire iCloud backup that is end-to-end encrypted is something that is valuable, and I'm sure they'll get around to it at some point, but that doesn't exist today. And that will be really interesting when, because obviously in addition to the like user-facing issues there, you then have the, well, what happens if we have a, you know, a suspected criminal come along, they use this feature, and then the government comes to Apple and they say, can you give us all that iCloud data you've got every other time? And they go, no, we can't, because it's so into encrypted and locked down, they literally cannot give them any data at all.
And presumably, like, iCloud locking down, it's not a device locked in time, it's iCloud, a living thing, and you won't have the workarounds over time.
Yeah, like physical access to the device is always going to be easier to hack into than like the iCloud servers, right?
Yes, yeah.
And if end-to-end encryption means that the data is literally entangled with your password, so you could dump the entire hard drive off the iCloud server, but if you don't have the password to unlock the bits, it's just going to look like random mess. So yeah, that is the real testing ground, is that when, you know, when they do roll out features like that, and in a few years time, when we do have another one of these crazy messes, Apple can't even be on the pedestal of saying, well, we gave over, you know, the gigabytes of information that we have from iCloud to assist in investigation. They'll be in a situation where they literally can't give them anything at all. And that's when they'll really come at loggerheads about policy concerns. And that fear is why at the moment we're seeing so much backlash in like the wider tech community, from politicians and governments, to things like Facebook announcing they're going to move their entire messaging platform to end-to-end encryption in the coming years or whatever. And every big company wants to add more and more end-to-end encryption features. But there are a lot of real-world pressures that inhibit or like come into play when that thing becomes widespread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you encrypt your Mac hard drive on your Mac?
Well, it's encrypted by you get the normal disencryption just by being on a T1 or a T2 chip, right?
Right.
But I don't do the extra step of adding my own password to it, no.
Okay, yeah. There was a time where that would take a performance hit, wouldn't it? And
yeah.
Now
they can do it, like, on the fly, so... Yeah. But, again, if you actually forget your full password, then you're kind of screwed, so...
Okay, well, yeah. Like, I do, and I do for Time Machine backups as well, just because why not? But my password is something I'd forget.
Well, and if you think about, like, your actual sensitive data on the laptop, most of it's going to be stored outside of that, like, will be on the internet somewhere anyway, like in an iCloud server or something, right? Like, that you're not protecting your photo library by locking down your laptop if you're still syncing all your photos to the cloud, right? To iCloud as it stands today, where all the pictures are stored. They are encrypted on the server, but the decryption key is stored with them, so they can be decrypted pretty easily with a subpoena or whatever. So
yeah,
it's kind of pointless if you think about it in that regard.
Makes you feel good.
Like, yeah, I know. Like, you feel happy and it gives you that confidence, but if you actually think it through in your head, like, it hasn't got a load of attention because obviously everyone just wants to talk about the backdoor encryption breaking. But if you think about that statement where Apple said, we've already given over gigabytes of data to the government on these phones, like, it just highlights how they do actually have, as much as they want to be the private company, just the features that they roll out mean they have to hold so much information on hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. All right. Let's talk about some Mac news this week, starting with a new version of the 2019 Mac Pro.
That was quick.
Yeah. The rack mountable version of the 2019 Mac Pro is available to purchase from January 14, 2020. So it's one of those things where, I mean, you literally couldn't buy this configuration in 2018, but it's still the 2019 model because of the internals. The casing is what's different in this instance.
It's funny, like, you have a 2013 Mac Pro, then you go 9 years without anything else, and then you get two models in the space of 2 months.
Yeah. Just seeing this thing, like, it's a little bit different from the not rack mountable Mac Pro, the default configuration. It's pricier for one, but also, like, the design. I mean, if you look at the back of it, it's just like a bunch of holes and not like tiny holes all over, and not the like super designed front of it with the you know, way more aggressive
circles. Yeah,
yeah.
It looks more like an X server, like the old like Apple servers.
Yeah, from the back side, and the front of it looks kind of normal, and it's like, you know, it's a wholly different case. It's not just a tweak on it. It's not just laying on its side.
If you do the maths, the rack mount is half the price of the Pro stand.
That's true.
if you have a desk and you want to rack mount your machine and then put your stand on top of that, put your screen on top of that.
Yeah. And because it costs more than the base model, it also raises the price of what the final, like, the highest Mac Pro configuration is. I think now we're at $54,048, and that will only get higher because there's a lot of options that you still can't get in the Mac Pro. Some are mid-level, but some are higher end, I believe. So we're still watching the 2019 Mac Pro roll out throughout 2020, it seems. Some other Mac Pro stuff. Jeff Benjamin has been all over it. He owns a 2019 Mac Pro and the Apple Pro Display XDR, our video editor. Of course, he needs one. And so he has done some amazing testing with what's possible in terms of upgrades. So taking the out-of-the-box Mac Pro and then using the modularity of it to take advantage of introducing your own hardware. In his latest episode of the Back to the Mac series on 9to5mac.com/YouTube, he's got a 24-terabyte solid-state drive. Just think about that for a moment. 24 terabytes of SSD that he put in. And then the RAM upgraded, there was 384 gigabytes of RAM. So I think this is like his daily driver now. So he's got 24 terabytes of SSD on board, not like, you know, a server and not a spinning disk hard drive, but SSD. So that's kind of remarkable. And I don't even think I don't think like if you price it out, it's not a crazy price. I don't see the price in front of me, but it's a lot of memory. 24 terabytes. I would be okay with 24 terabytes. and just that's possible, you know, it makes the base, because what's the base storage on this?
256 gigabytes.
256. So yeah, you get your 256 gigabytes, then you can upgrade to 24 terabytes of SSD, and then you're off to the races. So
that's literally like 100 times more.
Yeah, that's crazy. So that's really cool. And then finally, he has the Apple Pro Display XDR, and this week he published his video review. He says it has amazing build quality and a stunning view. So if you want to see lots and lots of hands-on time with the Pro Display XDR without going to one of the select Apple stores that has these, you can look
through. Yeah, his Pro Display video is really good.
Yeah, it's 17 minutes of Pro Display XDR. Goodness, so
still kind of want one. Yeah. Is it bad?
I saw on Instagram he was answering because he sort of manages the 9to5 Mac Instagram account, and he was kind of promoting the video before it came out, and someone asked if he'd pick Mac Pro or Pro Display XDR, and for him that's kind of a tough question because he can actually benefit from the Mac Pro, but he picked Pro Display XDR, I think, because there is nothing like it. Whereas with the Mac Pro is its own thing, but you can, there's also been like high end Macs too. So
yeah, and obviously you can't get an iMac Pro with 24 terabytes of storage in it, but for most like sane use cases, you can spec an iMac Pro to be within the ballpark, right, of what most people need to do, like video editing and stuff in general.
Yeah.
Obviously the Mac Pro is better, but it's closer than, you can't spec a Mac Pro with a really, really nice screen.
Yeah. I take it you haven't seen one of these yet, or else I've heard about it in person.
No, I haven't. I've just seen these videos.
Yeah.
Which I'm watching through my 15-inch MacBook Pro screen.
Yeah, we don't have a screen that's worthy to watch these videos. Our colleague Chance Miller was at an Apple store recently in Texas, and he saw the Mac Pro and the Pro Display XDR and sent me a picture. And I was just casually sitting there, like by the front door of the Apple store,
Did awesome. I tell you, by the way, I've got my 15-inch MacBook Pro that obviously has the terrible keyboard because I still haven't got it. Well, I can't, even if I get it swapped out, they'll just give me the terrible keyboard again, but a new fresh one.
That's on you at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I haven't got that done. It currently has three keys that basically just come out of their entire socket, like on a regular basis. So I keep them to like plug them back in. And to add matters to matters, I'm now getting service battery warnings. So I need to service my keyboard and service my internal battery.
Wonder what
the 2016 MacBook Pro.
Wonder what the Sensei app would say about your keyboard. Like, Well, I kind of think that you're going to go to a 20 or that you're going to go to a 16-inch MacBook. I just don't know if it's going to be this one or the next one that comes out.
Yeah, it's like I'll probably change. Like I'd probably be due for the laptop change. Like. This fall, if you see what I mean.
So yeah.
I'm trying to hang in there, but we'll just see what other components of the laptop start saying they need to require service.
Yeah. And if anyone has the Mac Pro mouse, keyboard, or trackpad with the silver and black colors, let me know. I'm looking. I'm shopping around.
The mouse looks good. I don't know about the keyboard. The keyboard color is kind of strange.
Well, my MacBook Pro is silver, and I've got a lot of silver peripherals, and my keyboard that I use is space gray. So, I would change to that one just for the. It looks good to me because it looks like the same as my MacBook keyboard, but as a external keyboard. Well, there's also some other Mac stuff going on this week. Our colleague Felipe wrote a story about a feature that we discovered in 9to5 Mac called Pro Mode that seems to be coming to Mac OS Catalina in a future version. What's Pro Mode, Mia?
Yeah, this is interesting. So. In the we found strings files basically that like pro mode underscore on underscore description. So again, the final marketing name can be changed on a dime. But what these strings basically seem to imply is that you'll be able to put your laptop or your desktop into a special mode where it will run the fans more aggressively. So especially on laptops, Apple is quite conservative in. When they turn the fans on the machine, which obviously helps with noise and it sounds, it sounds cooler when your fans don't blast out like maniacs. But to do that, that means the CPU is getting hotter, the components getting hotter, and they will throttle back and they won't last in turbo boost as long because they're not, they can't run at full speed at those temperatures. So in a hypothetical pro mode where you could force the fans to be on more often, to be louder, to be running faster, you could then cool. The internal components for longer, which would then mean you get more performance. You'd eke out some more performance out of it. So that is pretty cool. And obviously, a kind of like those kind of options, you've been able to sometimes hack in with some like Pram utilities or some special extras. But Apple hasn't to date offered anything in macOS really to have those kind of options. You get a couple of. Things in the battery options for like, do you want to dim your screen when on battery, and do you want to dim the screen when the battery starts getting low and stuff like that. But in terms of just like not overclocking, but general like CPU performance tweaks, this would be kind of their first step in that direction. So it's a cool option, but me, you, everyone on Earth wants the opposite of a pro mode.
Amateur mode.
Yeah, like low power mode, which they've had on the iPhone for 4 years now. That's kind of what everybody wants to come to the MacBook line, because if you have a 16-inch MacBook Pro, it has a 100-watt, it has a 100-watt battery in it. It's really big, but it has power-hungry parts to it. You've got the high-spec processors, you've got the dedicated graphics card, all of that stuff. The like Turbo Boost is good, but also if you run in Turbo Boost, that also drains more battery quicker as well. Mm-hmm. So if Apple's going to offer a pro mode, I think everyone collectively in the community is also hoping they will do a low power mode, which would do the opposite and like make your fan like turn off the dedicated graphics card so you can run wholly on internal graphics, turn off Turbo Boost. And so you would use that conditionally when you just want to be in like a plane or whatever, and you're using a MacBook Pro just to like browse the web or, you know, light work. And then when you're actually at your desk or you want to be, you know, proper working, you can switch it back into normal mode and take advantage of the power there. But the point is, people want the option to be able to choose at what level they're at. And on the iPhone, I basically never use low power mode. It doesn't really come into play for me. But for the laptop, I would 100% be using low power mode on occasions, because there are times when I know that the current speed and performance characteristics of the machine are beyond what I actually need for the current task. And I'm just kind of like wasting an hour of battery life for no reason.
Yeah, it isn't on the iPad either, is it? It's just the iPhone.
No.
Yeah, so it needs to go to the iPad. On the Mac, so on the iPhone, I'm kind of like you, where I rarely ever use it unless I'm in a situation where I'm just trying to really eke out as much battery as possible. But it's like, you know, once or twice a year. And you can do things. You know, one thing you cannot do is just run low power mode constantly, because it will turn off once your battery is recharged to 80% or higher. And then you got to flick it back on. But you can kind of look at the settings that low power mode is like one button for, and it's a bunch of different toggles that you'd need to go out and seek otherwise if you wanted to call it a mode and like enter it and leave it. But things like having mail not do background refresh, and Siri listening for the Hey command, and there's a lot of different things that it does. Even if you can't turn it all the time, you can sort of make that your all the time settings. On the Mac, it's kind of that way too, but not. I mean, there's some really they've got like a. On iOS, and they've got this like low data mode whenever you're doing hotspot. So they're starting to consider these things, and then like apps have to take advantage of them.
Yeah, because low data mode's new with iOS 13.
Yeah, so an app needs to be updated for low data mode. You've got to build it into the iOS before apps can take advantage of it. But like if it was on the Mac, you know, some apps would never update, but maybe the big, you know, heavy apps that you do use all the time and like are the most intensive would update for it. That would be nice. But for now, I'm doing things like, you know, what we'd like to see, which I've got, what's it called? The Turbo Switcher utility. Turbo Boost Switcher, where you can disable Turbo Boost to, you know, use the integrated GPU and not the discrete GPU. That's just for the processor, for the CPU to not use Turbo Boost. So you get slower speeds, but and you never go up to those faster speeds, but, you know, then you save battery life. And in most cases, I don't care about Turbo Boost. It's just whenever I'm doing things like, exporting a podcast from the edit and like processing it and everything, then I'll flick it back on for a moment and then turn it off when I'm done. And it does change the speeds, like not by several minutes, but noticeably. But most of the time, I don't want it to be in you know, max performance at the cost of battery life. So
the cost is pretty high for the extra speed that you're getting for very select use cases.
Yeah. And if I'm plugged into power, then like, I don't care Turbo Boost, all the way. It's just when I'm on battery that I care. So it's nice to have control of that right in the menu bar. Another app is the GFX card status menu bar app. And in my case, I'm not able to control which GPU it uses, whether it's integrated or discrete, but I can see which is being used at a glance. And then there's a mode in energy saver settings and system preferences where you can say to switch based on battery, to switch to the integrated one if you're on battery to save battery life. And then if you do certain things like if I launch Pixelmator Pro, even if I'm at the browse window, it's going to go to the discrete card. But I can see that in the status bar and I can say, oh, I'm not using Pixelmator Pro. Let me quit the app and then it'll go back to integrated. So it helps. I at least get to monitor that. And then if you're ever using an external display, it goes to the discrete card. But
yeah, the discrete graphics card always drives the external display.
Yeah, but in that case, I'm on power anyway from the display, so I'm not so worried about it. And that's kind of what I like. It's like when you're on power, then use power. Like use, you know, be as powerful as possible. And when you're on battery, just make that battery last as much as possible. You know, they've not done that yet. They make the small changes, like if you know, like system wide, even if you're on power, where if like an app is in the background, it can do. You know, it can not refresh until it's in front of like it's an active window. You know, any tabs in Safari, if they're not active, they can sort of time out until you go back to them. But yes, people on low power mode and they've done it on the iPhone, so it would definitely be a popular feature if it came to the Mac.
Yeah, and like low data mode for macOS would be cool as well, but. Obviously, like you said, that one has a drawback where apps need to update to properly support it.
Yep,
or
yep.
Maybe there could be like a high-level thing where you can just turn off apps to not allow them to connect to the network when you're in low data mode, full stop. But to be realistic, you want the experience where it's like you're using Twitter and it doesn't autoplay videos if you have low data mode turned on. That kind of stuff is more complicated and requires, you know, apps to support it. But something like low power mode is much more simple because they can just, you know, the system can manage the internal hardware
yes,
better
yeah.
and just get performance for free or get battery life for free, essentially.
Mm-hmm, yep. And maybe it could be things like never look for app updates in the app store if you're in low power mode, you know, or system updates, like all the things that, because you might not want to turn them off always, but if you really are concerned about performance and battery life, then you do have to turn them off always without going back and changing them. So, yep. And then finally, there's some evidence of new Macs coming. And the
singular.
Okay, new Mac coming. One's already came, which was with the Mac Pro rack mounted version. But another new Mac in every Apple blog's favorite Eurasian database, right?
Yeah. So the Eurasian Economic Commission, they filed. So Apple has to file in there because of like regulatory reasons, and it's generally between like a month to 3 months ahead of the hardware release. And so Apple filed in there for a new portable Mac computer. The model number is kind of weird, so we haven't really been able to, like, sometimes you can see if the model number is generally just like one above another one, you can very quickly tie it to a certain line. This one's kind of out on its own, so it's a bit of a shot in the dark. Some people think it might be the 13-inch MacBook Pro update with the new keyboard. Maybe it could be a MacBook Air with a new keyboard. Like, it's too early really to say for sure. If you wanted to guess, it's probably the 13-inch update because we're expecting that, you know, sooner rather than later, like springtime. But basically, there's a new Mac laptop of some description on the way.
Oh, okay. Well, but that wouldn't be the one that you buy because you want to go for the bigger screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually higher end specs all around. So.
Yeah, I mean, they did. They did the spec bumps for the 15 inches in May last year. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the earliest you could expect, like a 16-inch update. Or maybe the full or something. Because they've been pretty good recently, at least doing yearly updates.
And the 16-inch, it has the same processors as the 15-inch that it replaced, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so there's room for improvement there. It isn't like it's just from October. Yeah, it's kind of from earlier in the year, even though processor-wise. Yeah, to think of, you know, there's hope that the 13.3-inch laptop will be replaced with a 14-inch laptop, you know, like the 15.4-inch got replaced with a 16-inch. And if nothing else, like, it would just be cool to see the MacBook Air be the 13.3-inch MacBook and the MacBook Pro be, you know, half an inch bigger.
Yeah, finally have proper delineation.
Right. Now, just visually, yeah, you look at them and it's not just the wedge shape, you know, but what else is different about it? It's that. Is also a little bit bigger, you know, just like in phones, you know, iPads, you know. So we'll see what happens there. Finally, let's do some Apple TV news. There's a lot of small things going on all at once. So the first thing is a story that you covered over the weekend, which is a very short-lived documentary that was going to come to Apple TV and now is not, right?
Yeah, so there was this documentary about sexual abuse in the music industry. It was going to star Russell Simmons as the culprit.
Yeah, not star in a good way, but be the subject.
Yeah, not star in a good way, yeah. Like not demonized, but, you know, like show him to have done bad mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm.
That was announced by Apple very publicly with quite a lot of fanfare at the end of December. They had like a press release and everything, and Oprah was coming on to executive produce. But then, like, less than a month later, Oprah announced that she's stepping away from the project due to creative differences, and it will not air on Apple TV Plus. This one's like a weird one for me, because it's like, so she clearly joined the project late, and then in the space of only a couple of weeks, she's been so upset with how the film turned out that she's ditching it completely. Like, I feel like you probably shouldn't have, you know, maybe it almost seems like they announced it before Oprah even like seen the cut of the film.
Right? Yeah, which is odd. Yeah, I mean, she's got this overall deal to bring content to Apple TV Plus that she likes and backs. Is kind of the curator of that content. But yeah, it seemed like this was. I mean, the idea is that it's from the perspective of the accusers that are accusing Russell Simmons of inappropriate sexual behavior. The only thing that I, you know, comes to mind is something that you shared with me a few weeks ago, which is like literally an Instagram post from Russell Simmons appealing to Oprah of like, can't believe you're doing this. You're backing this. You know, none of this is, it's like his denial of everything. And that, I mean, I don't know. It's weird.
The Oprah statement, the way the Oprah statement is positioned is that she stood by the women involved. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like that she was upset that the film wasn't more critical of Russell Simmons' behavior. That's kind of how the statement was.
Yeah, her statement is first and foremost, I want it to be known that I unequivocally believe and support the women. Their stories deserve to be told and heard. In my opinion, there is more work to be done on the film to eliminate the full scope of what the victims endured. And it has become clear that the filmmakers and I are not aligned in that creative vision. So, right, exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, so that's at least what they're saying. Yeah. I just think it's a weird situation. Like it's not like an air power situation, but it's like they're just shooting themselves in the foot. Why did they announce this thing before like Oprah even seen the film she was signing on to?
Like, yeah, it was like a very hastily announced and maybe poorly vetted endeavor.
Yeah, and so now the film is still going to be released because it's whatever his Apple deal was. It meant that if they backed out of it, they didn't own it anymore. So it was going to be distributed by someone else at some point.
Yeah. Yep. So that's odd, a little odd road bump. And then Apple TV Plus has its first award that it's earned. It's been nominated for other things. This is specifically the morning show. But what's the first award that they've not only been nominated for, but actually won?
Yeah, so Billy Crudup, who plays Corey, is that his name on the show? He won Best Supporting Actor at the Critics' Choice Awards. Crudup's a really good character on that show, so it's cool that he won it. And mm-hmm. Apple's finally like broken through the barrier of having something to put on their little award shelf for Apple TV Plus. And the Critics' Choice Awards are, you know, pretty respected in the community of television. They're not quite on the same level as like Emmys or Golden Globes, or at least they don't have the public recognition that those names have. But you know, it's good and it's a decent start. You know, you've got one on the books.
Yep. I was looking at the TV app. So they would show before. When you do the carousel, that the morning show was
these Golden Globes nominated. Yeah, I don't think they put anything for the Critics' Choice thing.
Yeah, I wonder if they still tout the nominations even though they weren't wins. But it is something to be nominated over and over and over. So, so now there are some awards. Something else small that happened is that this week the creator behind the Little America series that'll be coming soon next month.
Today.
Today.
Today is in, because obviously we're recording Thursday. It comes out tomorrow. So.
Oh, so I was going to say, have you binged it yet? So, the creator of Little America, his name is Lee Eisenberg. He's now.
And he worked on The Office and a lot of other projects before as well.
Yeah, so he now has a multi-year content deal with Apple TV Plus. So they like
it. And in terms of critic reception, mm-hmm. Little America is doing better than anything else on the service at the moment. It has like 100% Rotten Tomatoes score or something. Like, it's kind of mental that the mm-hmm. first thing Apple released after like the cutoff date for the big awards season ended was suddenly the one that all the critics loved. It's kind of awkward for them, but there you go.
Yeah. So, and like you said, Little America is out on Friday, January 17th. So this is the multi-year content deal. Is it just like what HBO's former CEO Plepler is doing with Apple?
Yeah, very similar.
Very
similar. Setting up a production company, making content exclusively for Apple TV.
Yeah, okay. And then another movie was announced this week for Apple TV Plus, one that will be in theaters, sort of. Well, yeah, I mean, it will be. It's called Beastie Boys Story, and it's a music documentary brought by Spike Jonze, the famous director. And it's based on Beastie Boy.
He was the one who did that HomePod ad, right?
The
Moving Walls. That ad was so good.
Yep. So this is based on a book called Beastie Boys Book, which is the sort of nonfiction inside story of the hip-hop group Beastie Boys from the perspective of Mike Diamond and Adam Horovitz, who are the surviving members. And this is like the perfect kind of thing for Apple. This could be Apple Music if it wasn't for Apple TV Plus.
Is again similar to the Billie Eilish documentary that they bought at the end of the year that was also billed
for
TV Plus and not music. So
that's right.
Now we've got two things on the books that would, you know, in a past life would be Apple Music documentaries. And so
yeah, like the Taylor Swift concert tour, right?
Yes, yeah, or the Ed Sheeran one they did.
Yeah.
So they're definitely like putting all the future music stuff inside of the TV app.
Yep.
Like, obviously the Apple Music content does show up in the TV app, but like now it's like proper like TV Plus branded music content.
Yeah, and I mean this could be on any other service too. Like, it's just not weird that it's in TV Plus. It was more weird that it was in music, I guess, in the first place.
They're slimming down, and they're probably this is very speculative, but as they broach more like bundles, they could do something. There's more tie-ins to like actually put music content in the TV Plus section, because then if they do a TV and music bundle, you watch your music and then you can enjoy these great documentaries from your favorite artists as well at the same time.
That's true.
It for only $2 extra. Like,
yeah,
you know, when you go and buy a Billie Eilish album, Apple Music can have a nice little banner saying go and watch this in TV Plus. Like, they love that stuff these days. So.
Yep. And so like some other titles they've done so far, this is one that will have a limited theatrical release, specifically at IMAX theaters. And so IMAX theaters, they're not everywhere all over the U.S., but there are some. They are national. So I think, like, for me, I think I need to drive about an hour and a half or an hour to get to the closest IMAX theater. But they will carry the movie for a limited time at the beginning of April, a limited release, and then it will be available on Apple TV Plus later
April
in the
24th.
Yep. And this was the first time that we saw Apple acknowledge their capital S Spring 2020 lineup, which to me and you was a big hint that they've got more coming around the same time. You know?
Yeah, that was like the best part of this press release for me. Yeah. I don't really care about the Beastie Boys. It's a great band, go for it. But in the subtext here, it was like, we'll form part of our capital S Spring 2020 lineup. Yeah. And as soon as I saw the capital S, I was like, okay. So they're actually like formalizing like a package of content. And that's what it seemed like. And then the very next day, they announced that three premieres at South by Southwest, obviously the Beastie Boys thing, and then two new originals that they hadn't really talked about before. They got Home, which is like a documentary series about like architecture and cool houses. And then Central Park, which is like an animated series. It's made by the people that make Bob's Burgers, but it's nowhere near as like bleak. It's like an upbeat like musical comedy about a load of people saving the national park or the city park or whatever. That's what.
And it's got Josh Gad, and it's got Kristen Bell and Titus Burgess. So there's familiar names there. Yeah.
And so they, if you look at in that regard, that is actually the most upcoming stuff Apple has ever had on TV Plus to date. So the pace is definitely picking up, because right now we have on the coming soon list, you've got Mythic Quest on February the 7th, Visible on February the 14th, the Beastie Boys story on April the 24th, and then Home and Central Park, they said will be coming out in soonish, but they didn't actually have set dates yet. And then we got the resolution to the banker controversy.
Yeah.
They announced today that after doing their investigations into the allegations, they've decided to air the film. It launches in theaters on March the 6th, and then it goes on Apple TV Plus on March the 20th.
So we have something for January, as in today or tomorrow, and then we've got something for February, a couple things, and then we've got March with The Banker, and then March South by Southwest Film Festival premieres of three things, and then at least
and one then of maybe Home or Central Park count in March as well.
Yeah. Or April. Yeah, and Home is what I've been looking forward to, because both Home and Central Park we knew about by way of like the Hollywood Reporter style reports before TV Plus was official, and it was just like Apple's bought this thing about this thing, and that's been one thing that I like. Home is a show that I would watch. It's like you know, not a fiction show, but sort of a just documentary style show about the nice. I told you in the morning show that one of the things I liked about it was seeing Jennifer Aniston's apartment in New York.
Yeah.
You know, so this will be that, but a show.
Yeah, and then maybe on Sunday they might announce some more stuff, because we talked about this last week. On Sunday they're participating at the Television Critic Association. They're doing the Sunday show. Last week I was a bit skeptical about whether they're actually going to show anything new or just show some trailers, some stuff they previously announced. They definitely could do that with the, you know, four things they've announced so far this week. But given the spring 2020 lineup's got the, you know, their brand in it, I feel like they're going to have something announced on that day.
The significance of Capital S Spring 2020 is like, it seems like they think of The Morning Show and For All Mankind and C as like, that's the fall 2020 lineup, the launch lineup, and then some more things come from there. But that they and then along the way, you know, you've got Servant and you've got Truth Be Told and different things, but kind of just every few weeks. But it seems like by that formalization of Capital S Spring 2020, that's like round two of big shows. Maybe we'll see. I want to read the statement that they gave to Variety about The Banker, because it was sort of, you know, pretty controversial about what was happening behind the scenes. And so we literally thought at one point that they just would never be able to release the show, and based on some allegations. And so what they say is, we wanted to take the time to understand the situation at hand. And after reviewing the information available to us, including documentation of the filmmaker's research, we've decided to make this important and enlightening film available to viewers. And then they go on to say, we created Apple TV Plus as a home for stories that matter, and believe The Banker, inspired by brave actions of Bernard Garrett Sr. and Joe Morris, two African-American businessmen who brought about positive social change, is one of those stories. So yeah, they justify.
That's a pretty good response.
Yeah, they justify this. And I think key in that is saying reviewing documentation of the filmmaker's research. So that's where they can say it's, you know, there may be accusations about, but even if, you know, we believe that what we're showing is not just made up from the mind of someone who was accused. So
yeah, it's a pretty good response to
happened. Yep. And I will certainly, I mean, from the covering Apple and Apple TV Plus angle, seek out Apple TV Plus movies as they go in theaters, because it's going to be a whole new thing. And like every amount of screen time there will be significant, because it'll be like, you know, what do they show? Do they show trailers before and after? Like, you know, how does this all, like, how do they direct you to pay attention to the streaming service too? You know, they're doing this for awards so that people like Spike Jonze can be eligible for awards for the content that they can probably win awards for. Does it vary from seeing any other movie in theaters? So I don't know about you and what'll be available for you, but for me, I'll definitely be seeking these movies out in theaters just because of the Apple connection.
I don't like theaters.
Really? What's your theater experience like in the UK? Like, we get to, it's improved lately where we get to pick our seats ahead of time. You can be as late as you want to, and then you walk to your seat and it's like a reclining seat, and it's really nice.
Yeah, I don't think our chairs are quite as nice, at least we have those like reclining seats, but you have to pay extra for them.
So yeah.
It's kind of like a thing. I don't know, like the theater is nice or whatever if you go with a group of people, but in general, I kind of like watching stuff at home.
There's one theater near us that that's brand new. That you know, there was one in South Florida. I lived in South Florida called iPick, and you could, you know, you sit down and watch a movie. And I saw the Steve Jobs movie with Ashton Kutcher there, and your ticket includes a blanket so that like if you're cold you can cover up, and obviously you recline, and then you get a menu and you can place an order during the movie, and then they bring like a like dinner to you. It's really nice. And there's something similar to that near me now, where I live now. So I saw that when I saw Star Wars.
But yeah, maybe I'd seek out to see one of these because of the, you know, Apple connection. But if right. it was just like a run-of-the-mill film, I wouldn't go. Like, I actually think The Bankers looks really good. And I've been wanting to watch it. But the only kind of like films that I really take the effort to like go to an actual cinema for are like Avengers or, you know, like big like CGI effects, you know, that kind of thing. Like, The Banker isn't that, right? It's like a cool like story movie.
So. What's the last movie that you saw in theaters?
Ooh. I watched a Marvel Avengers. I think that was the last one.
One of them, yeah.
One of them. Yeah. I didn't watch the most recent one.
Oh, okay. Well, all right, that's all right.
The one before that.
Yeah.
Where okay. was.
Endgame, maybe. Yeah, Infinity War. I don't know, whatever. But the last two movies I saw was Cats both times. I went with my brother-in-law once because no one would go with me, and I saw the trailer and thought, this is brand new to me, but I kind of like what I'm seeing here, you know, whatever. And I went and I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. And then I was obsessed with the soundtrack. And
you're the Cats fan. We found
and then some. Yeah. And then I deep dived through the history of Cats, and then I bought the 98 movie, and on Apple Music I've been listening to the 83 Broadway recording, and I seeked out tickets to a performance, and they were sold out near me. It's like, but then first time I went, it was like one of the first few nights, and so there were people in the theater. The second time I went, it was when the rest of my family decided they would go with me. My other brother-in-law, it turns out, was like a huge Cats musical fan from like being exposed to it as a kid, and knew all the songs like more than I did. And so I decided to convince him to go. And he had my sister and brother-in-law have a 2-year-old. I have a 2-year-old and then a 6-year-old. And it was all of us parents and the kids. And because it was Cats on like the last week of it was showing on a Monday at 4 o'clock, nobody was in the theater. And the kids could just run around and play and dance and sing, and we could watch the movie. So it was, you would have liked it. It was like being at home, but you know, you're on private theater. So, and what's the thing my daughter said was, we got to seek out more movies that no one goes to so the boys can run around. It's like, it's not very common, but yeah. So yeah, I will be paying attention to when The Banker comes out, so I can see it in theaters. And maybe I'll go like during work hours since it's work related. Really
nice.
Really bring it home there. All right, a couple things to promote before we head off for the week. The first thing I want to mention is this week's episode of 9 to 5 Mac Watch Time, my Apple Watch podcast on the network. I have part of my goal this year is to do 24 episodes, so two a month, and part of that being possible is you know, it's usually an interview show with somebody else, but I learned that I've got a lot to say myself in the area, so every other episode or so, I'm going to do a solo episode. I did one last year that was received well, so this week I did my second solo episode, and it was funny. Like, it was 15 minutes longer than the guest episode before it, so that's just me in front of a mic. And then the next thing is homework for everyone. If you haven't watched For All Mankind on Apple TV Plus yet, I recommend that you do before you listen to next week's episode. So that's as much as I'll say. And if you watched it once, but you kind of, you know, you enjoyed it or you want to watch it again, this would be a good excuse to do it is for homework. Because it will be a topic next week, and, you know, we'll get into detail on the show. Not just, you know, there will be spoilers. So you've been warned. So definitely do that. And, with that being said, this is the Happy Hour Podcast. We will be back next week with a brand new episode about For All Mankind. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZac. That's APOLLOZAC. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.